Jesus wanted to include people in, and Paul talked about including people in. So in my previous church, I led a team of churches through the process of admitting children to communion. And it was a complicated process. I consulted with the bishop. I got in touch with the Anglican Church in New Zealand, who had done this a little bit more than we have in the UK. I got a hold of a priest from another part of the diocese who had also admitted children to communion. We had committees and councils and coming together and consultations and surveys. And over a process that lasted for about 18 months, we drew up a whole policy and established it and consulted everybody, and eventually we admitted the children to communion at my previous church. And it was wonderful, wonderful celebration, and the children really learnt what it was all about, and it was an exciting time. And then I moved on to St. Barnabas. And I think it was first or possibly second week at St. Barnabas. It was a communion service, and I bumped into Helen Shannon, and I was new. I didn't know what I was doing half the time. And I said to Helen Shannon, have we admitted children to communion here? And Helen Shannon said, oh, yes, yes. So I thought, marvelous, 18 months of work I don't have to do. Fantastic. So I got up to communion and I said, of course we love our children to receive communion because they've got real faith in Jesus. And so just bring your children up and they can receive communion as well. And we had a wonderful time. And then on the way out, person after person came up to me saying, well, that was wonderful. We've never done that before. And of course, once the cat's out of the bag, you can't put it back in, can you? So we've done it ever since like that. And I think it was a kind of better way to do it than all those committees and councils that I'd done in my previous church. I want to read to you the first ever recorded, written down words of Jesus. They're the first record we have of what Jesus said. And they come from 1 Corinthians, but I'll just read it to you. Listen to this, because they're really important words. These are the earliest documents that we have of recording Jesus' words. The Lord Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took bread. And when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, and these are the first words that we have of him, this is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me. For whenever you eat and drink this, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. I tell you, it just gives me goosebumps just reading it. The very earliest record of the words of Jesus. And that's it. What does communion mean to you? I'd like you to turn to the person sitting next to you and just chat about that question for a couple of minutes. And maybe it means nothing to you, that's fine. You're on a voyage of discovery, I hope. But maybe it means the world to you. But just chat amongst yourselves for a moment. What does communion mean to you? Conclusion? I wonder how you got on. Have you ever thought about it before? Are you ready to have your thoughts expanded? I hope you are. Well, this sermon is entitled, Why Communion? But I want to start off with, what communion? What is it? Well, it has its origins deep in the Old Testament. The Old Testament story, when the children of Israel were in Israel, in Egypt, in captivity, they were slaves to the most powerful emperor in the world of that day, the Pharaoh of Egypt. But they were a covenant people in relationship with God, and God was going to deliver them through the prophet Moses and set them free from slavery. And it was that in that context that they celebrated the Feast of Passover, as it was called, and each year thereafter, the children of Israel, the Israelites, celebrated this Feast of Passover by eating a Passover meal. And it was at a Passover meal that Jesus shared with his disciples that he took the Passover meal, all about freedom from slavery in Egypt and God's deliverance out of that freedom. And he applied it to himself, saying that he was the Lamb of God who was giving his life for the world, and that he was going to affect freedom from sin and death for those who put their trust in him. That it was his blood spilt that was going to be the sacrifice. And from that moment on, we have this this act of worship, communion, as we call it today, or some people call it the Lord's Supper, or some people call it the Eucharist, or some people call it the Mass, whatever you call it. We have this thing where we act out this meal, a remembrance not of the deliverance from slavery in Egypt, but the remembrance of the delivery from slavery to sin that Jesus has done through his blood sacrifice for us on the cross. That's what communion is. But what does it mean? What does all that business with bread and wine and stuff, what does it mean? Well, down the ages, different sectors of the church have taken different views on what communion means, on what is happening to the bread and the wine. And I want to suggest that there is something of a spectrum of opinion. At one end of the spectrum, you've got the Roman Catholic Church with the doctrine of transubstantiation, where they believe that the bread and the wine, in some mystical way, is actually physically transformed into the body and blood of Jesus Christ. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the Swiss reformers from the Zwinglian Church, who believe that that actually nothing happens to the bread and wine at all. It's just a visual aid and a memory prompt. Again, talk to the person next to you, because you should be able to place yourself somewhere on that spectrum. In the middle, we've got these other things, a real presence, a consubstantiation. They're sort of halfway in between something that is nothing happens to the bread and something really peculiar happens to the bread. So you may, where on that spectrum are you? You may be with the Catholics, you may be with the Zwinglians, or you may be somewhere. Just talk to the person next to you. Where do you think you are? And are you prepared to have your view changed? Wonder about having a vote, but maybe that would be divisive. But I would hazard a guess that most people at St. Barnabas are probably towards this left-hand end of the spectrum. That you're more to do with it being a remembrance service than actually something physically happening to the bread and the wine. Well, is that fair? Yeah, I think people are nodding. I'm certainly not going to the far right of the spectrum myself, but I wonder whether God's got something extra for you tonight, that whether actually a fresh perspective will come for you. We'll see. If you want to know more about this, do get the download of Colin's sermon this morning, or buy a CD from the bookshop, because it's an absolute masterclass, particularly on the doctrine of the real presence. If you want to find out what that is, Colin's sermon will really expand on that for you, and indeed the history of the Eucharist and much more. But I think Holy Communion means three principal things. Maybe I'm being simplistic, but I think it means three principal things, and it starts off reasonably easy to understand, and it gets more difficult. Three things. First, it's a proclamation. Remember from 1 Corinthians it said, whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. In other words, it's a restating of what Jesus did for us. It brings us back to the cross. It reminds us of Jesus' ultimate victory. It reminds us that actually the cross wasn't the end, that he went on to rise from the dead and ascend to glory. It is a remembrance in that sense of the amazing sacrifice that he did. It stirs our hearts, doesn't it? When we reflect on the cross, on the magnitude of his sacrifice for us. And we act it out. We act it out with bread and wine. And somehow it gets through to us again. Just the enormity of what Jesus did. A proclamation. That's the first thing. And I guess that everybody here would say, yeah, I can get that. I can understand that. Second thing, it's getting a little bit trickier now. The second thing is, I believe it is nutrition. Spiritual feeding. Now, this is more difficult to understand. But Jesus himself, the very first ever recorded words that he spoke, says, this is my body, doesn't he? He doesn't say this represents my body. He's saying something much stronger than that. This is my body. It's something real. It's tangible. It was also Jesus who says in John 6, my flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood remains in me and I in him. It was so shocking at the time that practically all Jesus' followers, bar the 12 disciples, abandoned him at that point. They said, this is too hard to accept. We don't get this. You know, are you advocating cannibalism? What's going on? My flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. There's somehow that through acting out bread and wine, that we are fed. We are fed in our spirits. It's more than just a remembering. It's more than just a visual aid. There's something going on here. We're feeding on the living bread, as Jesus referred to himself. The bread of life. And through actually taking a little bit of bread and a little bit of wine, combined with our own faith, something spiritual happens in us. We're strengthened, we're fed, we're nourished by it. I believe that's what the New Testament teaches. It's more than just a remembrance. There's a genuine spiritual feeding going on. So that's the second thing, nutrition. The third thing is getting more difficult to understand. Union. Union between us and God. Don Boylan said this, "For Paul, it is a common union." That's where we get the term communion. It's two words, common union, first couched by Augustine. "It is a common union of God and man." St. John Chrysostom says, referring to Paul, that we are not just participating with Christ in receiving communion, we unite with him. This union is not a mere metaphor, it is reality. The words common union means literally together union. There's a coming together. We unite both with each other, but more explicitly, we unite with God. Our spirits become one with God's spirit. In the phraseology of John 15, we remain in him and he remains in us. This is covenant language. Last week, my eldest son got married. Yeah, it was. It was a bit like that. It was really amazingly exciting. A few of you guys were there. It was a wonderful time. He got married. And of course, marriage is talked about as a covenant. And in a covenant, you get two people and they come together and they become one. In the ancient Near East, if you had two tribes come together, you would have one tribe join with the other and they would become one tribe together. And they would form a covenant between each other, saying that we were two, but we are now one. And the result of that is that everything that belonged to, all the rights, all the property, everything that belonged to the other tribe now belonged to the whole tribe together. The same in a marriage. We say, all that I am, I give to you, and all that I have, I share with you. When you get married, you say those words. It's a coming together. That you have all the rights, you have all the property, you have everything that the other person has. Now, we are a covenant people with God. Are you getting this? That when we come together with God, we have a common union with God. And we get all the rights, all the privileges, all the resources, all the property of heaven. In fact, Paul goes on to say, we're already seated in heaven. We're there. I know it doesn't always feel like that. But we have, by covenant, everything that God has, he has given to us. Common union. We come together with God so that we can truly say that he is our God and we are his people. And as with all covenants in the ancient Near East, it was always sealed with blood. And it even was at Ollie and Liz's wedding because we had a hog roast. So the pig had to die, unfortunately, and we enjoyed it very much indeed. But a covenant was always sealed with blood. And we know that is true with the new covenant, the covenant in Christ's blood. A coming together of us and God. Is that awesome? Is that profound? When we take a little bit of bread and a little bit of wine, we are, in some strange way, reasserting that covenant with God, becoming one with God once again. Let's backtrack a moment to the Passover meal Jesus had with his disciples and to what the early church in the New Testament times carried on. What was it like? Well, of course, right at the beginning, it was a Passover meal. I once had the privilege of going to a Orthodox Jewish family and sharing in their Shabbat meal on a Friday evening. And I was surprised when they passed some bread round and we shared bread. And then they passed a cup of wine round and we shared a cup of wine. And it made me realize that from time immemorial, the Jewish people have been doing this. Just a little reflection on the Passover. Of course, they have a big Passover celebration once a year, but they actually do a little reflection on it every Friday evening. And that was what it was like. It was a Passover meal. It was over a meal, In fact, the bread was taken halfway through the meal, and the wine was taken at the end of the meal. So it sort of enveloped the meal. And then in the New Testament time, of course, many of the new believers weren't Jewish. They were Gentiles. And so they adapted this great Passover thing into a generalist feast, which they called a love feast. Where they would share their food together. People could come irrespective of class or caste. Free men would sit alongside slaves. Sociologically, it was absolutely radical. A revolutionary sharing of food with a prophetic meaning. It was and inviting God into it. It was having dinner with God. And what's more, of course, they were expecting the return of Jesus. Each time they sat down to have this meal together, they were thinking, you know, is Jesus going to walk into the room like he did in the resurrection appearances? That wasn't so far in their history. It was just a few years before, perhaps. So they were expecting maybe Jesus would walk into their presence that very evening. And they would be in there knowing God's total redemption. It enabled them to have an almost unbelievable courage in the face of intense persecution. That's what it was like. These people gathering together, sharing everything, knowing God in their presence, eating together. But what has it become? What has it become? Well, it's changed a bit, hasn't it? Wolfgang Simpson says, what we have now is a pious and symbolic shell of the original meal of tasty lamb that Jesus shared with his disciples. William Barclay said, the celebration of the Lord's Supper in a Christian home in the first century and in a cathedral in the 20th century cannot be more different. They bear no relationship to each other whatsoever. So what's gone wrong? Where do we lose it? How do we get back to the dynamic of that kind of radical self-giving that we see in the New Testament church, that life-giving thing that was the Lord's Supper for them? Well, you've probably heard the story of the man who asked for directions, and the answer he got was, well, if I was going there, I wouldn't start from here. And that couldn't be more true of communion. You know, we are where we are now, aren't we? We have a certain practice, and it's difficult to know how we can redeem it, how we can get back. I'm not sure we can go backwards. We have to go forwards from where we are. But I have got a couple of suggestions. And the couple of suggestions are that we shift the spotlight and that we let God in. First, we shift the spotlight. We shift the spotlight. I think so much of the focus of Holy Communion has been on the bread and the wine and what they mean and what's going on there. And of course, I've been talking about some of that. That's where the spotlight, in a sense, has been even this evening. I want to suggest that we shift the spotlight. The spotlight shouldn't be so much on the ritual. It shouldn't be on what we do so much as what's happening in our hearts. The spotlight shouldn't be on the outward form. Of course, that is of some consequence, but rather, isn't it more important what God is actually doing in our hearts? That we need to shift the spotlight onto our relationship with God. I think that's what John Calvin, the great reformer, was getting at when he said, "Feed on him in your hearts by faith with thanksgiving," which is a line that has come into our Anglican liturgy. Feed on him in your hearts by faith with thanksgiving. That we want to shift the spotlight away from the bread and the wine, which are really, really important, but onto us and our covenant relationship with God and what's happening in our hearts and where we are with Jesus, where our faith is, how we're doing in our lives. How close are we to God? What's going on? Shift the spotlight onto that. Because that's the real stuff, isn't it? It's my first suggestion. We shift the spotlight. Second suggestion is we let God in. Let me ask you another question. Is Holy Communion for you more about what God does for you or more about how you respond to God? Is the movement downwards or upwards? Which do you think it is more? Do you want to chat about that one for a moment? Now, who said that it was more about what your response? Who thought it was more about your response? Ooh. And who said that it was more about what God does for you? I think the God does for you has it just, but there are an awful lot of don't knows in there, aren't there? It's quite a tricky question, isn't it? I tell you what, I think we default back all the time. I know this is true of myself, but we default back to trying to earn God's favor, don't we? I know in my own heart, I'm always, trying to live up to expectations of others and possibly, if I'm honest, expectations of God. That's the default position. We're trying to earn God's favor. Now, I want to suggest to you that in a covenant relationship between us and God, God is always the prime mover. He loved us first before we loved him. He always acts first. That whilst we were still far off, he met us. And when we respond, that's what it is. We respond. He's moved first. Now, we in the Protestant or Reformed end of the church, if you like to call us that, we often run scared of the Catholic doctrines of transubstantiation, which you mentioned earlier. And rightly so. because of their massive over preoccupation with the elements of the bread and the wine, and also the tendency towards kind of a magical folk religion. In fact, you know the term hocus pocus? You know that term? That originates from a corruption of the moment in the Latin Mass when the priest waved his hands over the bread and the wine. And the people at the back who couldn't hear the Latin clearly would say, oh, he's doing the hocus pocus bit. And that's the origin of it. And it's a bit like that, and that makes our flesh creep a bit, doesn't it? You know, all the Protestant hackles rise in us. And we think, I don't want any of that. But in rejecting that, sometimes we miss something. Sometimes we miss the fact that actually, perhaps communion is more about God reaching down to us, doing something for us, than it is for us doing something for him. We need to let him in. There's many times when I've been, it's just an enormous privilege actually, to give out bread and wine. There's many times when I've had people come and receive bread and wine and just break down in floods of tears as God surprises them again and breaks into their hearts in a fresh way that they weren't expecting. Communion needn't just be a remembrance thing, having nice thoughts about everything that Jesus has done, however good that is. But it can be more. It can be much more. It can be a spiritual transaction of encountering God. This is about us and God. We need to let him in, to open our hearts to him. Something of what John Calvin, again, called the wondrous exchange. This is what he writes in Institutes, Book 4, Chapter 18. Becoming the Son of Man with us, he made us sons of God with him. By his descent to earth, he has prepared an ascent to heaven for us. By taking our mortality, he has conferred his immortality on us. Accepting our weakness, he has strengthened us with his power. Receiving our poverty himself, he has transferred his riches to us. Taking the weight of our sin on himself, he has clothed us with his righteousness. The wondrous exchange. That as we make a covenant with God, he gets all our stuff, and we get all his stuff. I want to invite you to receive the bread and wine. It's a prelude to the glorious feast of the Lamb in heaven. It is just a prelude, just an appetizer. But I want to invite you to encounter God through it. Can we have the band up? Joe, I don't know what you're going to do, but I'm sure it'll be wonderful.